Host Harlan Mono Logics. Number 00017. Recorded on February 7, 2023. Production location, Post. Harlan. Texas. In a gotta da vida baby. In a gotta da vida baby. Chapter 17.
The opinions of Maverick 88 are not necessarily the opinions of Maverick 88. Sensitive content warning. Viewer discretion is advised.
Now, buckle up. You are on the runaway train of thought. Ladies and gentlemen, without any further ado, the one, the only, Maverick 88.
I expect that everybody's got their own package of fundamental, foundational beliefs, right? The beliefs that kind of create the parameters and framework of one's worldview, as they say, right? The worldview. And I would have to say one of my foundational beliefs that kind of set that packaging of my worldview as it is the idea. Well, let me just put it to you the way I put it to myself and anybody who I talk to about this, right? That science as we know it is merely man's discovery of the art of God. That science is man's discovery of the artistic genius of the creator of all things. And though I imagine that's pretty self-explanatory, let me elaborate in the event that for some of y'all out there, it's not quite catching your attention. Culturally speaking, I think all of us have a tendency to ascribe a certain elevated status to our scientists, right? Like they say, quote unquote, trust the science. Like, as if the rest of us are too fucking stupid to comprehend scientific ideas and ideals, right? But we put people of a scientific mental aptitude on a pedestal of sorts. I mean, I do it too. I respect those who are more intellectually adept than I am, because there is a difference between people. Not everybody is the same level of genius or the same lack of genius, as the case may be. You know, surely people's, as people are different based on their constitution and based on their experience in life, some are more intellectually adept than others, right? And I'm kind of somewhere in the middle of that pack. You know, they have an IQ that is above normal, but it's not exactly through the roof either, right? Not exactly through the roof either. So when we put these people on a pedestal, the people obviously respond by carrying themselves in an aloof manner, as you know, they're, as if they're a very special breed of humanity. Do they do significant things that are helpful? In a lot of cases, yeah, you know. In a lot of cases, they're full of shit too. You know, let's just be honest. Sometimes science is trying to establish and substantiate preconceived narratives. It's always been the case. You know, people are scumbags and they like to validate their scumbaggery. But this is not the point I'm trying to make. The point I'm trying to make is, you know, as elevated and as aloof as highly intellectual, scientifically oriented people may or may not be, whatever they concoct in their formulations, whatever they discover in their investigations, is really just small potatoes in the grand scheme of things, right? I mean, our greatest scientific discoveries and our greatest inventions, anything that humanity does that is great, is almost invariably some cheap replicant of the creation that the creator of all things already put into place. And whatever we create, we are creating with something that the creator created. There's no way around the idea, you know. We want to, in many cases, you know, as humanists and as atheists, desire to imagine ourselves as the be-all, end-all, right? Like, we are the intelligent beings of this planet and perhaps entire star systems and maybe even galaxies, right? We like to think we're great like that. So that gives us the potential to actually be the greatest. And as soon as we throw the idea of a singular creator of all things into the mix, well, that kind of steps on our toes and it kind of messes with us. We don't like that shit, you know. We don't like that shit. We don't like the idea that there's a God that is so great that makes us look so pathetic. And even in Scripture, you know, you read through the epistles that Apostle Paul wrote, constructed, that kind of concept where God actually uses the high-mindedness of people to express the ultimate stupidity of humanity. You know, not only is it said once, it's kind of a recurring theme, not a whole hell of a lot of times, but more than once. You know, Paul kind of goes there. And I say here on this podcast, you know, one of my, again, I'm talking about foundational beliefs, right? One of my fundamental notions is the idea of the fear of God being the beginning of wisdom, right? We just don't really have a great understanding of anything until we actually bring God into the picture. Not that God is necessarily going to reveal some of the greater details of physical science to us. He may. It's not to say he won't either, but what I'm trying to say here is we don't have things in the proper context when we try to eliminate a singular creator of all things from the equation, right? And that's what that Bible verse, it's Proverbs, what the hell was it? I forget. I bring it up every once in a while. So it's, you know, something that Solomon said. It's the wisdom of Solomon in the Proverbs in the Old Testament, or the idea of the fear of God is the beginning of wisdom, right? It's creating the context for all human discovery, invention, creation, right? Think about it. Just that word creation, right? You've got a creator of all things. He creates something that has the ability to do what? Create. Isn't that insane, right? We're able to create because we were created by a creator who could create creative beings. Wow, that's heavy shit. That's heavy shit. But anyway, I have this fundamental thought. I have, my worldview is within that construct. The fear of God is the beginning of wisdom. And it's the idea, similarly, that anything that we could discover, uncover, imagine, create, invent, it's just really scratching the magnificent genius of God. What I call the art of God, right? The creation of all things is artistic. And science is like the uncovering of the intricacies that make up all of creation. So anyway, that's a little bit about me, and how my worldview is, the parameters of my worldview are kind of set up. And along with that, I get this idea. See, I do believe that man is discovering things. And I do believe that our Earth is is older, significantly older than the 6,000 plus years that so many Christians are able to extrapolate from Holy Scripture. Right? I mean, that could well be the age of civilization, right? 6,000 plus years. But like the physical Earth itself and the universe and all creation, I still believe can be gazillions of years. And I get that from the same Bible. When I read the Bible, see, I believe in what's called long day creation theory, right? That is, some people are literal, like 24-hour solar days, right? As our Earth spins around one rotation and we go from darkness through day back to dark again, we have a 24-hour cycle. We call it a day. People being egocentric, all right? There's that word again. That comes up a lot when I'm talking, right? The egocentricity of people will look at creation, the days, I mean, there are days in creation, but they will attribute their own personal experience and figure a day in creation is just like a day here on the fucking job, and going home to your wife and kids and dogs and, the same day. God experiences the same day, the same 24-hour day as we do, and all creation was done in the quote-unquote literal week, right? 6 days, and then the seventh day God rested, right? Creation occurred in that very minimal time frame. Can God do it? Yeah, he could. Did he? I don't think so. I don't think it happened like that. I think it unfolded not in human days because, as creation began, there was no sun. there was no sun to base a day off of. There was no rotating earth to base a day off of. Right? You didn't have an Earth day initially. There was a light, and that light dictated day and night. But it's a different light, and it was God's light, and it was God's day and God's night. And from our perspective, that even Scripture says, I think it was Apostle Peter who wrote, the idea of like a day to us is... or a thousand years to us is like a day to God, right? And the use of the word, the number thousand back in the old days, in the ancient times, was just like this infinite number, right? An infinite number. Just think in the course of our lifetime, like if you're old like me, like 55 and up, you're a baby boomer or you're Generation X or something even older than all that stuff. There's probably still a handful of people from the greatest generation alive, I would guess, a couple of them. You come from back then, you lived at a time when $1,000 was a hell of a lot of money. And millionaires were very rare. And billionaires were like Rothschild rich. Now you're talking about trillions as a normative number. You know, we do, our federal government does budgets, and it's in the trillions of dollars, not in the millions, not in the thousands like it used to be. And what I'm trying to convey here is the idea of, through time, the value of numbers has changed, right? We need greater and greater numbers to express the worth of things, where as you go further back in time, you needed less and less of account to express that same vastness, and things that approach infinity. So the number 1,000 was used like that 2,000 years ago. That's just is just general number that represents something innumerable, right? We could look at that concept and fit it right into here. The idea, like I'm expressing, of long day creationism, where God's day would be like an infinite number of years to us. That God has his own days, and those were the days that were applicable in the creation story in Genesis 1, right? So, that's kind of how I began to frame, like, time, you know? And then we have science that goes into, like, dating rock formations and fossils and shit like that, you know? And I believe the way I look at creation and time, it allows for a lot of that dating, right? It's like, how can you have Christians who have, like, the literal creation week, you know, man's 24-hour days, 6 days of them, you know, and then the seventh to rest, and then have our discovery of the art of God, as I say, right? That seems to be utilizing our scientific methods, showing times that goes back greater than 6,000 some odd years. And in a lot of cases, most cases, significantly greater than that, right? I believe that my construct for time, for history, for creation, for civilization makes the most sense and allows for our science to work into what scripture has set for us, right? And it turned out to be a big deal to me, because I was in a Baptist church. I was a member in a church, and I was a Sunday school teacher and everything like that. And we had the pastor who I was a little iffy about, for a couple of theological reasons. And the one that really just set me off, and it's not that he believed in the literal day, it's that he thought that the long day creation was quote unquote stupid, right? And we had this Bible study. It was a Bible group that he was conducting on a Wednesday, which is like the day for a Bible study in Protestantism in general, right? And it was, you know, we had a couple of classes, I guess, but his was the big one that was done in the main room, and you probably had like 50, 60 people in there, and it wasn't really all that interactive. It was really just your preacher up there telling, you know, laying down the law, telling you how it is to be a Baptist and what you ought to believe and what you not ought to believe. And he got on this long day creation. He was talking about how he had a buddy in seminary who believed like what I'm expressing versus what he believed as those human 24-hour literal, you know, creation week days. And he got done summarizing what he had to say and all his story on the fucking subject, he just flat out said, now if you out there believe in long day creationism, you are just plain stupid. Oh man, and that offended me. I'm not easily offended. That fucking pissed me off. It's like, you know what? My ideas are thought out, calculated, within reason. I don't consider myself to be a stupid person. I've done a lot of foolish things in my life. Yes, you could call me the fool, but I ain't fucking stupid. And neither is this concept that I have that I actually find to be foundational and really more normal, you know, more inclusive. Not that we strive to be inclusive over what God gives us, but if God gives us something that tends to be inclusive of our human endeavor, you know, to understand the past, doesn't that make a little bit more sense? How the fuck can you even call it stupid? You might differ, and I could be wrong, but it ain't stupid. And that was it. I quit. I quit his fucking church. I was done. That was like the last straw with him. And I moved on, you know. It's difficult. Like Genesis, it's the book of beginnings in the Bible. And there's just a lot of things that are really difficult along the way. You know, understanding creation days and times, a sequence of things is difficult. It's a little wonky. There's some expressions in there that are kind of vague. It's just adjectives and descriptors of things as creation is unfurling. You know, and then you get into like just some of the basic stories as you go through Genesis that are difficult. Of course, you get to Genesis 6 and it talks about the Nephilim and the sons of God. And so many people kind of attach themselves to that. That's like the introduction to the Bible for many, right? The whole ancient astronaut theory is connected to that, you know, but it is very mysterious. That's my point. There's a little latitude for thinking and supposing, reckoning, based on that very limited amount of information that Genesis supplies there, right? Later on in the Bible, you get a little bit of add-on to that to kind of help your calculations a little bit more. And when you learn to get into some of the pseudepigraphal text that are, you know, valid within orthodoxy, as I've learned to understand, like the book of Enoch, for example, and the book of Jubilees, you can get a lot more detailed information that really expresses more of what the fuck was happening with that, right? So you can get a little bit more information on these things that are mysterious. But other examples, you dial it back a little bit, you know, like, what was it, Genesis 4, you had Cain and Abel. You had the sacrifice, and Abel's was acceptable to God, but Cain's was not. We don't have an explanation of what was going on with that, with the whole sacrifice thing, and why God would be so mad at Cain. It didn't seem to make sense in black and white. You'd find out later, as you read more and more through Holy Scripture, what that sacrifice was supposed to be, and what it was all about, why Cain was so wrong, right? But you didn't get it right there in Genesis, and that's the point I'm making. Genesis was kind of, it's got a couple of kinks and ripples in it that make it difficult. You don't read it like a storybook. You know, you try to, and then you keep on catching these little spots that snag you, don't really make sense, and are very difficult to get past, right? Bible's not meant to be read cover to cover, A to Z like that. It's really not. You know, the best bet for anybody is you start with the Gospels. You know, pick one. Luke is generally a good one for people in America. You read Luke, and that becomes like the central point of understanding of what's going on in the Bible. And then from there, you could bounce around to the rest of the New Testament, go back into the Old Testament, and things start to kind of fall more into place, right? There's a way to read the Bible, and there's a way not to. And A to Z, cover to cover, it's not that kind of a book. It's really not. It was not made that way. It's a collection of books. It's not just like one book with chapters. It's a collection of books. And the logic of it all is not chronological or sequential. You follow me? All right. So another difficulty is you get, like in Genesis, you start with Genesis 1, you have this creation, like this creation week of time that I was just describing. And then all of a sudden, like in Genesis 2, you go from that, which is kind of like the macro, and then you kind of like hone in on the micro of it. And it doesn't seem to make like chronological sense. Something wonky just happened in there, but that's all that's really happening is, you know, we're taking what the creation story was saying about ultimately the creation of humanity, of mankind, And then it's like focusing in on the very specific details of it. It speaks of it in general at first in one chapter, and then it hones in to like the details of the very beginning and what was going on. And then even in there, you got a lot of like head scratching going on. By Adam having a rib taken out of him to create a woman, that's a little fucked up, right? What helps with that is having an Orthodox priest to explain. I'm not going to do it here, but I've asked the question and I've gotten the explanation. You know, the scripture, tradition, doctrine, all this stuff, there's a history to it all. And I'll get into that eventually as we go. Maybe today, maybe not today. It's a lot. It's a lot. But all that's really happening there is just like this transition to like more specific aspect. Like I call it the macro to the micro, right? But again, Genesis is a difficult read when you don't really know quite what the fuck is going on. You know, and then you go in, you know, from Genesis 2, you go into Genesis 3. Now you're talking about this Garden of Eden thing, right? The Garden of Eden, and what happens with the serpent, which is weird, right? Tricking the woman, and a woman eats the forbidden fruit, and then all of a sudden they're dead, but they're not dead in the sense that we understand death to be. So it doesn't make sense to us again. It's like God said that they were going to surely die, and they don't surely die in the way we understand it, but they did. You just don't understand the biblical meaning of death, right? So Genesis is difficult, and you're in the Garden of Eden. And then where the hell is the Garden of Eden, right? It mentions four rivers that don't exist. In fact, I remember, you know, being a kid in the 70s, right? You know, I've been watching Star Trek and Spock. I'm a Spock fan. Leonard Nimoy, the actor. All right, Leonard Nimoy, the actor, he did a series in the 70s. It was spun off of movies that were done by Rod Serling, the Twilight Zone guy. He did a series of three. One of them was In Search of Ancient Astronauts, right? Going back to that whole idea again. So some producers picked up on that, and they made like a television thing, a series called In Search Of, and every week it was in search of something different. One of them was In Search of the Garden of Eden, and I think it was 1978 or so when that one aired. I looked it up at some point previously. I think that's what it was. And yeah, I used to watch that shit with my father sitting around watching TV, and I'd be fascinated by this kind of thing, right? And no, they don't know where the fucking Garden of Eden was. And the Bible mentions four rivers. Only two of them actually exist. What happened to the other two? You know, it's where the hell is it? Nobody really knows, you know. But Scripture said that, what? It was shut down to Adam and Eve. They were kicked out of the garden. And, you know, the cherubim angels set up flaming swords to prevent them from coming back. And whatever and wherever the Garden of Eden of Eden was, it ain't no more, you know. It's not findable. And again, there's another thing, right? The Garden of Eden, In Search of the Garden of Eden, they didn't have an answer. They tried, they posited a bunch of stuff. I don't remember exactly where they went with it. Were they leaning towards like the mountains of Ararat? That's kind of how, like, where Noah's Ark settled, according to Scripture. I think it might have been on those lines. It wouldn't be far off. There's been a whole lot of different theories about where that may be, you know, down the Nile in Africa, Ethiopia, out in Persia, obviously like in Sumeria, with Ur, you know, the beginnings of civilization. So I've read where it's like buried in the Persian Gulf somewhere, you know, a whole lot of things. In Search of the Garden of Eden, the search continues, right? And that reminds me, there was a song, I used to listen to as a kid, well, as a teenager, right? It's kind of, it was heavy. It was 60s music, but it was kind of heavy. It was Iron Butterfly, right? Iron Butterfly. They made a song called In a Gotta Da Vida. In a Gotta Da Vida, baby, don't you know that I love you? In a God of the Vida, baby. Right? Inagata Davida, and it was like this 20-minute song, like a whole side of an album, and the middle of it was like this really long drum solo from hell. And just had like this heavy, like distorted bass sound. Dun, 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 dun. Something like Beavis and Butthead would love, you know, if they were hippies. But Inagata Davida is actually like a slurred way of saying in the Garden of Eden, right? How many of you knew that, right? No, a lot of you probably never even heard the song. But if you did, yeah, that's what it's about. It's a, you know, something about the Garden of Eden. You know, with Iron Butterfly, probably on drugs. There's a video of it you can watch, right? There's a video that they did. They had a shortened version of it where they kind of truncated or minimalized the drum solo in the middle and fitted into like a 45 format for, you know, hit production, top 45 airplay, shit like that. But yeah, Iron Butterfly, Inagata Davida. Iron Butterfly, butterfly, right? I go back, I think Butterfly, I remember a period in time, like the grunge era, that's when the girls started getting like tattoos and piercing. Yeah, it became a thing. It wasn't just for like military anymore, you know. Piercing wasn't just to tell people that you partied, you know. It used to be like, how was it? When I was a teenager and I was in the East Coast, you pierced your left ear and it told everybody you were partying. If you pierced your right ear, it told everybody you were queer. And then on the left coast, the West Coast, it was opposite of that. But the same idea. You're just opposite ears. So it's weird, right? So you had that idea going on with the piercings. And that's about as far as the piercings went, you know. Girls pierce their ear. They, you know, in that era, punk rock, they would start piercing like multiple piercings on their ear, like all the way up around their lobe and everything like that. And that was kind of out there, right? But in the 90s, in the grunge era, people started just piercing everything, nipples and clitorises and everything. Just whatever you could pierce, they would find a way to pierce it, you know, the nose and the lips and the eyebrows, everything was getting pierced. And that's kind of when it came into fad and fashion. And, you know, with that, the tattoos, and everybody's getting tattoos. Used to be guys would get tattoos. They'd go off to the Navy and they'd come back with like a Popeye anchor on their forearm or some shit. Like, you know, I was in the Marine Corps. I didn't get a tattoo in the Marine Corps, but I do have a Marine Corps tattoo. It's a rifle expert badge. It's not really like big USMC Bulldog or anything like that. It's kind of subtle. If you know it, then you know it, you know. And that's kind of how I roll with that shit. The tattoos I have, they're all regrettable. And they, you know, I'm sure that so many of the women got tattoos that were regrettable. And this is what I'm talking about. The butterfly tattoos, they seem to be a thing. I had a couple of girlfriends that had butterfly tattoos on the small of their back, on their chest, on their ass, right? It was kind of a butterfly, some on the shoulder, like they had the angel on the shoulder, the whale tail started to come in, like they had that little upside down triangular fitting the small of the back, you know, which was, it accentuated kind of the slimness of a woman. But of course, you know, all these tattoos, like the butterfly tattoo is a great example. It's cool when you're 18, maybe when you're in college, 22. Well, what happens to a butterfly tattoo when you're like 45 and 60? You know, your butterfly becomes a fucking pterodactyl, right? And yeah, that would be kind of regrettable, right? When we're young, we don't realize that we're actually going to be old, like those people that we make fun of. Like you make fun of me now. Oh, the fucking dude, 55 years old and shit. Well, you know, I was 18 also. And, you know, my parents before me were 18 also. And it's pretty much the same thing. The only thing that changes is, I'll use the word before, fad and fashion, right? Style points, maybe some of the lingo. But really, everything is pretty much the same. It's pretty much the same. We all go through the same. And we all see things the same. We never, like, understand our mortality. We've got that Superman protection on it. We're never going to die. We're surely not going to get old, right? And then you find out you do. Good. We all pay the price for being young by getting old. And there's really not much of a way out of it, you know, not much of a way out of it. You could stay young to a degree. I'm doing pretty well for a guy my age, you know, physically fit. I look okay, I guess. I feel really good. I feel much younger than I actually am, you know. And I think it's always the case with people. We never really recognize ourselves as being 55. We recognize ourselves as being, you know, we're forever 18 or 17. That's how it is with me. It's like I think of me and immediately I'm back in the early 80s, you know. And I don't know. But I sort of kind of know. But yeah, butterfly tattoos become pterodactyls. And, you know, we didn't think that at the time. And butterfly, we got this butterfly theme going on. I remember, I bring up the Doors every once in a while because I was stupid. And, I was a Doors, a Jim Morrison fan. And one of the Doors songs, right? I mentioned earlier, earlier episode, The End, right? The 11-minute song. He had another 11-minute song on the next album, which is called When the Music's Over. And in that, he has this line about wanting to hear before he dies, you know, before I fall into the big sleep, I want to hear the scream of the butterfly, right? The scream of the butterfly. I know a lot about the Doors. I have no idea what the fuck that is, you know? I got some thoughts in time. And a lot of them are kind of, they're a reach. It's always going to be a reach with this shit because you really don't know. You know, drug-induced rock and roll song lyrics, they end up being very personal to the person that wrote it, you know? And only they know. Only I was watching an interview with John Anderson from Yes, right? Yes has very abstract, obscure lyrics. I mean, that's what English bands had always done. Everything's got to be a fucking mystery with them. They can't write a relatable song. I complain about that because, like, the music is always really good, but the lyrics are just, what the fuck, right? And John Anderson's lyrics are, like, a real high degree of what the fuck. They really don't make any sense. To hear him talk about his lyrics, he even laughs at himself. It's him in his own imagination land, smoking weed. And he says so, you know. You know, he'll have like this 2-3 word little phrase that he'll throw out in a song that means something to him and it means nothing to nobody else. And then he'll do a song that has a sequence of these phrases. I think of Siberian Katru, for example, right? He has these sequence of a couple of phrases of all this stuff that means something to him and means nothing to nobody else. And you can only really appreciate the music, the song, based on the feeling that you get from it. And that's exactly how I address Yes. He could say whatever the fuck he wants. It's the melody and the music that set up an atmospheric mood that works for me in certain moments of my life, right? It serves as a really good backdrop. In certain moments of my life. And because the lyrics mean sense, of course the lyric... Let me start again. Because the lyrics don't make any fucking sense, you can make of them whatever you wish them to be. Right? So, there's that. But anyway, that is off on a little Yes tangent when I was talking about the Doors, right? The scream of the butterfly. What I think of now, is like... Was that dude talking about like all the Monarch programming? Right, Monarch programming, where the butterfly was like a representative symbol of that, and the scream is like the sound that sets off the program person to go and do what they were supposed to do. We'll talk about that a little bit more. I doubt that's the case, but I mean, because of his connection with his father, the military industrial complex, his time on Laurel Canyon. And I've talked about this stuff before, right? The whole idea about the CIA subverting the anti-war movement with hippies to create controlled opposition and basically negate their efforts, keep that war machine turning, right? Jim Morrison had an attachment to that whole structure, that whole cultural phenomenon, Maybe, you know, maybe. But and that could be just some drug-induced hallucinogenic bullshit, too. He was tripping and saw a butterfly. He wanted to hear it scream. So what did he do? He stepped on it or some shit like that, right? Tried to, tripping out. Maybe it could be that stupid and just simple, right? That, right? But, yeah, they put a little Texas slant on the whole butterfly thing. We get the big monarch, right? The monarch butterfly, which you see everywhere, right? The black and orange butterfly, kind of sizable. They're migratory patterns, you know. They summer in Canada and they winter in Mexico, so they do like a beeline coming and going through Texas twice a year, right? In the autumn and then again in the spring, right? They come down south for the winter during the autumn to September, October, and which is the best time. If you're ever going to visit Texas, come down October. It's a great time to be in Texas. Weather's excellent. And then you can see butterflies. Or come in the springtime, you know, you can catch tornado, hailstorms, see the Texas blue bonnets all over the place, which is very interesting. And you might be able to catch these monarch butterflies leaving Mexico and heading back up to Canada, March, April, around then, right? So they got the big monarch migration. And there's some places along the way where they actually set up for you to go and observe it, right? And DFW, they have one. Where the hell was it? I read about it. I'm trying to remember. Grapevine? Over in the heart of DFW, somewhere between Dallas and Fort Worth, one of the towns over there. I think it's Grapevine. They do some kind of like monarch butterfly festival on an annual basis. I've not been to, but now I got to look at it and see. It's probably worth taking my wife out and going checking that out this year. So that's a little DFW / post-Arlen twist to this whole butterfly deal. You know, that's the monarch butterfly. And you hear the word monarch, you think of what? Kings and queens, like monarchy, right? And I guess the big news, well, you know, it's February now, but back in the autumn, a couple of months ago, the British monarchy, right? The Queen of England died at a ripe old age of 90-something. And that's a big deal to people. I don't understand the big deal of it. I never did, but it's always been like on the tabloids, the royal family this, the royal family that. I'm American, and, you know, like, when I dial everything back, Britain is still the fucking enemy to me, right? They were what we fought against. The British got some kind of natural inclination to like towards world domination, like Hitler. Right? I put that in the same league. I may be different than you in that regard. I probably am, you know. A lot of us have taken very kindly with Britain through the British waves of invasion of rock music through time, right? As I speak, I'm always talking about these English bands. That's what I grew up with, right? That I have a fondness for that. But, it stops with that, too. I go back. I grew up. I wasn't raised to be patriotic, but I was very much so up until in junior high when my mind just fucking exploded, right? Well, you start to see the reality of the situation versus the what's the word I'm looking for? The optimism of it all, right? Once upon a time, the United States started as a country based on all these great ideas with all this kind of hope for mankind, and 200 years later, this is what we've got, you know? This is the fucking mess that we're in. This is how the Statue of Liberty was pillaged and raped, you know, by so many criminal people. That's what the land of milk and honey, an opportunity. It's a place to come and just lie, cheat, steal, and kill, right? A long history of that. And it's all culminated into the modern era as it stands. I'm very interested to see how this plays out. But yeah, the British monarchy, they were in place at that time. They're still in place now. And, you know, I look at, you know, you had this phenomena, cultural phenomena back then during the Revolutionary War, where you had people that were revolution-minded. They were American colonists that were fighting against the crown of Britain. But then you also had people over here that were loyal to Britain and not revolutionary in their minds. They were called loyalists, right? So I believe that at some level you have people who are still loyalists over here, and that's why you have such a affinity for all things royal family, British royal family. I am just not that fucking guy. Monarch. I don't know. I mentioned about the monarch program and before. We're just going to move along from this whole England-British thing, right? The monarch programming, that's something that was, what, developed out of the CIA, right? CIA experiments they were doing, which I believe in turn comes from the Nazi mind control experimentation and other kind of fucked up experimentation that the Nazis were doing back in the 30s and 40s, you know. They were known for doing all kinds of crazy shit to test the bounds of humanity, to learn how to take advantage of people, control people, kill people, torture people, all kinds of fucking crazy shit. I mean, it was the evil of all evil on Earth. And, you know, don't you know, we had brought such wonderful scientists, there's that word again, from Nazi Germany into the United States, bypassing all the Nuremberg hangings, right? We brought scientists into here as part of what was called Operation Paperclip back in the 40s, you know, primarily involving rocket science, right? Because shortly thereafter, we adopted the Nazi German science program and began putting rockets up into the sky, getting up into orbit, sending chimpanzees and eventually people, right? And then the whole idea that we made it to the moon and shit, which some dispute. But anyway, you know, as soon as we had Nazi rocket scientists, we had rocket science in the United States. And then we were going toe-to-toe with the Soviets in the space race, right? Which in turn created a whole lot of space age technology that became useful for us at the household and industrial level, right? So it was a good thing, you know, it was a good thing ultimately. But the other part of the Operation Paperclip, it wasn't just bringing scientists over. We brought a lot of intelligence over, right? Intelligence. And this is where we swapped out our army intelligence as it was for World War II at that point in time, and developed from that the CIA. And there's a whole story about the people involved with that. You had people who were senators and central bank people. They were tied into Nazi Germany, and they were able to get these people to come over, and the Dulles brothers, and all this shit tied together, the Bush family. And it created the CIA. And as you know, George H.W. Bush was in the CIA. He was ultimately the director of the CIA before he became vice president. Integrally tied into Central Intelligence Agency, right? And we had brought in all these Nazis, these Nazi intelligence personnel people through Operation Paperclip, and it changed the way we did things, and we started doing this fucked up experimentation, which included all the acid tests of the 60s, right? With the Grateful Dead, they were giving away all the free LSD to see how it worked on people. Our own, well, CIA, I don't know. Nobody owns a CIA. They fucking central banks probably do, right? But, you know, in America, American intelligence agents were doing experiments on people. I just call it what it was. And part of that was this thing called monarch programming. learning how to program minds. And the conspiracy theory idea of it is they use this monarch programming to create kind of robotic automaton response psychologically in people to go and do their bidding, like assassinate somebody, for example, right? So, yeah, monarch programming is what it was called. And, it, you know, the emblem of it was the butterfly. And, you know, it has ties to all the Nazi mind control experimentation. And I mentioned this quite apparent linkage between monarch programming, right, done here at home with the Central Intelligence Agency and all the Nazi mind control experimentation that was done back in the concentration camps, which kind of hits home with me a little bit because I have family history that went through those camps, right? So there's a little bit of a factor about that. Maybe a little bit more so with me than the next person, but that's a story for another time, you know. But my father was born in Dachau, right? Imagine. Anyway, moving on from that, there's apparently linkage established between American mind control experimentation and Nazi mind control experimentation. And the linkage is Operation Paperclip, which brought over not only rocket scientists, but also intelligence people. The intelligence people came over, teamed up with Army intelligence, and established what we now know today as the CIA. Right, the CIA. So now you've got Nazified American intelligence performing mind control experimentation in the 50s and in the 60s, which include the acid test phenomenon with the Grateful Dead and other means of experimenting with the shock and awe and terror and weird things, you know, eyes peeled back, people on LSD and shit, you know, all kinds of crazy stuff that they were doing. And God knows the extent of the craziness. I don't put anything past Nazis, you know, just after what I read and heard and seen, like, in documentaries. I put nothing past the wicked that such people are able to perform and the shameful suffering that innocent people have to had to deal with, you know. And the thing about this monarch mind control, you know, I'm talking about all this JFK stuff, right? This, the infighting between President John F. Kennedy and the elements of both the military-industrial complex and the CIA, who were both integrally involved with profiting highly from our entry as a nation militarily into the Vietnam War, which was not our issue. It was a French thing, but, you know, the spread of communism and all this stuff, right? It's the same people now who are spreading communism in here. You know, the whole, everything fucking goes 360 eventually, you know? But anyway, that's way beside the point. I'm sorry I even brought that up. Anyhow, you had this infighting between JFK and the military-industrial complex slash Central Intelligence. And it was bad. It was very bad. JFK did not want to go into the Vietnam War, and he stood up against it and spoke out against it. He had all kinds of lock and horns with the Dulles brothers, who were basically the leadership of the CIA, and he shit-canned one of them, and that made a lot of bad blood. You know, was it the only bad blood that JFK made? No. So you can't say outright that it was the CIA who did this assassination, but a lot of the fingers and avenue, you know, fingers point that way, avenues lead that way, walks like a duck sort of thing. But you know, somewhere in this world there probably exists the official story under lock and key, with the families and the corporations, the intelligence community as a whole, you know, playing guardian to it all. Now, that's a story that those fucking people want to tell. They just can't, because they'll hang if they do. But they want to tell that story. So they're keeping it. It's somewhere out there. I would love for it to turn up along the way, eventually. But why do I bring this all up again, you know? The relationship between Nazis and our Central Intelligence leads to this whole war hawk attitude, you know, profiteering off of war, that transcends the dividing line between both political parties. You know, that's something that's in the interest of profiting, you know, political profiting is in the interest of everybody involved, regardless of party. And that's why we, for example, we had George W. Bush's endless war on terrorism change hands across the aisle to the Obama administration and continue on, you know, without missing a step. People, you know, rich people profit off of that shit handsomely, and there's no secret to it. Look up Smedley Butler and some of the things that he incurred between the world wars, right? He was a Marine Corps general who was actually asked by the elite powers that were at the time to foment a revolution utilizing veterans, he decided not to be party to that shit, and he actually spoke out publicly about it. And that's a kind of like hidden history that you don't get in school. Look at Smedley Butler, actual real person, right? A general, Smedley Butler. But you know, going back to the whole JFK assassination, he had a lot of enemies. Right? He made enemies with the mafia, especially in cahoots with his brother, who was the Attorney General, right? The Attorney General for the United States. And he was ruffling the feathers of the mafia. So you had a problem with those people. And of course, that's Bobby Kennedy, RFK. He ended up assassinated too when he was making his bid for the President of the United States in 1968 on the campaign trail over in Los Angeles. And, you know, the idea, the conspiracy theory involved is the guy who killed him, what was it, Sirhan, was actually a part of this mind control, this monarch programming set up with Central Intelligence. So he was like a pawn and a puppet in their game. And when they sent out the hypnotic suggestion, for lack of a better word, he took up arms and went and performed the assassination that he was programmed to do, you know? I don't know how true that is, but that's kind of part of the story as far as the conspiracy theories are concerned, right? So you had that monarch programming involved with the assassination of Bobby Kennedy. And there's a lot of this that have done, like, you could read and view all kinds of stuff about these assassinations and all the different angles, all the different avenues, all the different players and participants, all the different theories that certain people have, you know, books upon books, movies upon movies, documentaries upon documentaries, interviews upon interviews. There's all kinds of shit to see about JFK / RFK assassinations. My particular favorite, right, the one that pretty much expresses my inclinations to all of this sensational intrigue of the 1960s. I wish I could remember the guy's name. I cannot do it. He was some kind of UK, I don't know, Brit or Irish or something like that. But he did this very long and thorough, extensive documentary called Everything is a Rich Man's Game, right? Where the premise is, through history, you had like monopolists, robber barons, super elite wealthy people who have the power to control everything, controlling things. And when it came to the JFK assassination, well, they controlled the CIA. They profited through the Department of Defense and the military industrial complex, right? The whole idea is that all this stuff was dictated by the super wealthy of the world, whoever they may be. And everything is tied to military-industrial complex, like I keep saying, and intelligence, you know, military intelligence, central intelligence, all the intelligence, and everybody involved with it, right? And the whole cover-up was covered up by the same people. I talked about the Dulles brothers, for example, right? One guy was fired, like kicked out of the leadership of the CIA, only to return to be part of the Warren Commission that was dictating the official story of the JFK assassination. You know, like the number one culprit, the first guy you would think of who would have something to do with killing Kennedy is actually on the commission assigned to establish the official account of what went down. Come on, man. That's fucking bullshit. That is complete bullshit. And this is part of, you know, the angle that this guy in Everything is a Rich Man's Game expresses, right? And of course, all this stuff, the assassination happened right here, you know, Dallas. I live in Dallas County. I'm one town. You know, my town borders the city of Dallas. Downtown's a little bit deeper in. Dallas, you know, is large. It's a large, expansive city. But it doesn't take up the whole county, right? I'm one of several cities within the confines of Dallas County. Not far to go. Not far to go. You know, in fact, I'll take a ride on my Harley, you know, like early on a Saturday morning before anybody is awake. If it's a nice summer day, I'll get on the bike. And I'll go right through downtown Dallas, you know. I'll cross it in one place and I'll come back out another way through all, like, the canyons of all the tall skyscrapers and everything. And just right down, you know, there's no cars out. It's a fascinating ride, if you could just imagine. You know, people up north, you know, riding around in, like, the financial district on a Harley. What would that be like, you know? Shit, on a bicycle it would be cool. But on a Harley, it's something else. You know, your motor's rumbling and it's bouncing off the wall. It's really fucking cool, right? It's one of my favorite rides. I like riding the country. I'm a country person, but I'll do that every once in a while. And the route that I take, I actually get on Elm Street in Deep Ellum, right? Deep Ellum is a section of Dallas. A lot of y'all deadheads might be familiar with their song Deep Ellum Blues, right? A lot of history, a lot of musical history in Deep Ellum. You know, of course, my favorite, Reverend Horton Heat, they come out of the Deep Ellum scene in the 80s, early 90s, and they play there every year. You know, they always return, when they come home, they go and play down there. I want to see them down there, but I haven't pulled the trigger on it because Deep Ellum at night is really a pain in the fucking ass. It's a place for college kids to go and get drunk, and yeah, I'm 55, you know what I mean? The Reverend Horton Heat's in his 60s, but, you know, he's probably got the key to Deep Ellum. You know, like, people get the key to the city. He's a figure down there. I am not. And parking down there is a pain in the ass. That's just, you know, I've done shit down there, but the shit I'd done down there was before City of Dallas kind of started to micromanage the parking situation, you know, for profit. They really just fucked it all up for me anyway. Other people may enjoy it, but you know, Elm Street runs right through Deep Ellum on the east side of downtown Dallas, comes out under what, 75 and into downtown proper, all the way across to the west side, and this is where the assassination happened, in a section called Dealey Plaza, right? You've seen the pictures, the Zabruder video and all that, you know, with the big lawn and the grassy knoll and the little wall up there, you know, the book suppository building, like they say in Full Metal Jacket, right? The Texas School Book Depository building has now been converted into a JFK museum. They call it the Sixth Floor Museum. So tourists go down there to take in the ambiance of presidential assassination in this country, which really, I believe, changed things for the horrible worst that it has been since and is now, and fiction to continue to be, right? Because the power, the people that took over the power are the scumbags in the country. I think intelligence, defense, contractors, corporations, profiteers of every kind that just rape the Statue of Liberty, basically. It's pillage and plunder with criminals, you know, literal, like pirates, right? And this everything is a rich man's game even makes mention of that. The Skull and Crossbone Society in Yale. You know, the Bushes are famous for going through, and John Kerry, right, crossing aisles, and so many presidents and shit like that through time. There's Skull and Crossbones. Well, what the hell is that? That's the pirate flag, the Jolly Roger, right? These are the people that have taken over this country, and it's piracy. You know, it's literal fucking piracy. That's how I see it. You know, I agree. I concur with the person that created that documentary. Everything is a rich man's game. So yeah, Dealey Plaza is right to Elm Street. And when you think of Elm Street, just in general terms, I mean, every town, every city's got an Elm Street, right? But, you know, in pop culture, we have the series of horror movies called Nightmare on Elm Street. And I watched the first two or three when they came out because I was a teenager. That kind of shit was geared towards people like me back in the day. And they went on to make, like, God knows how many dozens of sequels and shit to it. You know, they clearly jumped the shark somewhere early on, but they managed to stretch it out into this empire, making whatever money they make on it. But my thinking, you know, when I look at this and I think about the JFK assassination and all the parties involved, the conspiracy theories and all the different angles. You know, the fact it comes down to it happened on Elm Street. And I have to wonder if the Nightmare on Elm Street is somehow representative of the thoughts of whoever wrote that fucking story, Nightmare on Elm Street. Or what that person thinks about the JFK assassination. You see where I'm going with this? Is there some kind of symbology involved with the Nightmare on Elm Street that expresses something about the JFK assassination? Probably a reach, but who knows? I mean, you could have made it Nightmare on Maple Street, Oak Street, Main Street, any fucking street, but they chose Elm for some reason, right? Elm, and don't remind me of Elm. Elm. It was my elm tree from hell in the fucking backyard, right? Half of it split off and it fell across the back alley and it took out a chunk of my fence and it went in the backyard of the neighbors and I had to get out there with the chainsaws and cut all that fucking crap off. And that was half the tree. The other half was still standing, and then it started coming down branch by branch after I made plans with a tree guy to come and cut the rest of it down. Well, before he showed up, it starts coming down and all the core branches up the middle of the tree. And one of them landed kaplunk right on top of one of my fucking tool sheds, destroyed it. Yeah, my fucking elm tree, right? Elm, elm, elm. But yeah, so there you go. There's all this stuff. I don't know how the fuck I went from where I started to where I ended, but there you go. That's Post-Arlen Monologics for you. Adios.
Thank you for tuning into Post-Arlen Monologics. Please understand that this project is meant to be part of a long-term archive as a series of snapshots reflecting a distant past. We are not seeking advertisers, but may at times accept private anonymous donations to help mitigate production costs. Further information involving this project and archived releases of Post-Arlen Monologics can be accessed over the World Wide Web at postarlen.com and at onsert.com. Comments, critiques, and inquiries may be submitted to Maverick through email at maverick88@postarlen.com.